It's the Tyson Talks edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, atheist wins, drug trials, forgiving abortion, and interview with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Let's begin episode 129.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword from politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Dylan, your political science philosopher.
Joining you again is Jenna, your biochemist.
I like how you sort of did that almost in the third person. It's kind of weird, sort of. I mean, it's okay. Jenna is here, Dawn is here, and Ethan is here.
That's right.
I'm talking in the third person for the rest of the podcast.
Good.
When you should have said Jenna, we'll talk in the third person.
Good call.
Speaking of weird things. One, Ethan, you have an update. We did a boo-boo last week when we introduced our new Lethbridge listeners.
Well, not a mistake by us. What was it?
Of course. We never make mistakes.
No, for listeners in Lethbridge, you have finally got Radio Free Thinker on your local radio station. We reported that it would go on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM. However, this has changed. The show will actually air Saturday at 9 a.m. instead of Wednesday. So be sure to check out Radio Free Thinker Saturday, 9 a.m. CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge.
And to all those listeners in Lethbridge, this was just a primer to make you skeptical of the things you're told. You were told it's
absolutely
Wednesday, in fact, on Saturday, so please tune in.
Speaking of being skeptical about some of the things you may have heard, I've heard some things on the CBC lately that, well, frankly, just made me go, eh. Apparently, placenta pills are becoming an industry or a business. Although it is quite common in mammals to eat their placenta after giving birth, and for those who don't know what a placenta is, look it up. I ain't going to describe it to you.
Men.
The practice in human culture is relatively quite rare, although not as rare apparently as I thought it was. However, in Saskatoon, a businesswoman is making a folk remedy out of them, and she's doing so in such a way as to make it easier for new mothers to swallow the material.
Absolutely a pun intended.
The businesswoman fills blue capsules with a brown powder. What's in that brown powder? You can already guess. It is steamed, dehydrated, and ground up placenta. Proponents say ingesting placenta can boost energy, promote healing, fight insomnia, and stimulate, breast milk production. It also claims to help ease postpartum symptoms. Now, for those of us in the skeptic community, a lot of these claims sound like you're generic, like swallow this snake oil and it will cure anything that's a problem with you. Now, granted, this is a bit more complex because, again, some people in this room believe that there's a lot of hormones in there. Although, again, after steaming and dehydrating, I question how much would be left. But again, it just struck me as a weird sort of folk remedy thing that doesn't seem to have a lot of scientific basis behind it, although huge cultural implications. You were talking about it beforehand, Jenna, not that you've ever partaken in this particular industry, but women, you know, when they go to the bathroom, apparently stuff actually does go on where they have these meetings and they get together about stuff. No.
You can send your complaints to Dawn at Radio Free Thinker.
To Dawn. No, well, actually, there's a little bit of a culture, and it's not necessarily that widespread from what I understand, but there is some practice in human women to eat their own placenta following birth or parts of it in order, again, to sort of recoup some of these nutrients as well as potentially any hormones that might be there that affect sort of postpartum process. But my practical question for this particular article is, whose placenta's in those pills, Dawn?
Oh, well, not mine, obviously. But no, apparently women will package or have their placenta sent to this woman who processes them, in quotes, and then ships back the pills.
Oh, so it is your own.
It is, well,
ostensibly.
From what I understand, it would have to be your own. Otherwise, it would constitute cannibalism, which I still think is illegal, at least as a food supplement.
I think it's illegal to sell and ship human parts that aren't for, like, scientific medical purposes.
Yeah. If anyone knows more details about this, that would be interested. I'm also interested, too, because, I mean, in essence, this is kind of Well, not a herbal supplement, a nutrient supplement. And what regulations does this person have to uphold to make sure, you know, is it clean premises? Are there any, you know, I mean, we were talking beforehand, you know, is it safe to do this? And on the one hand, sure, it's your own placenta. I mean, anything it has, you already had beforehand. But what about in the processing? Is there any regulation for supplements at all in this particular instance?
Man, if I was this woman, I'd have a bin full of placentas in the back and a bunch of pills full of ground up Cheerios.
That sounds actually very familiar to many other big placebo manufacturing, actually.
Yes.
But speaking of not this at all anymore, Don, you were telling us.
Let's shift gears.
Yes. You were telling us about a teacher in California. Continue.
Yes. Well, apparently, teachers can't be sued for bashing Christianity. Woohoo!
Wait,
neither can radio hosts. Well, yeah, no. A federal appeals court ruled Friday that a California teacher, James Corbett, could not be sued for criticizing Christianity and creationism during a college-level European history course. Corbett said during his class that serfs opposed social, political, and economics that were in their own best interest because of religion. He compared creationism to magic and made 20 other comments that were disparaging towards Christianity. After which, a sophomore, Chad Fernan, alleged these were disparaging and sued. He sued in 2007 after dropping out of the class. At least he had a decency not to complete the class.
He apparently was there long enough to tick off those 20.
Yes. Court ruled that, and this is going to sound scary, but let's finish, in broaching controversial issues like religions, teachers must be sensitive to students' personal beliefs and take care not to abuse their position of authority. But teachers must also be given leeway to challenge students to foster critical thinking skills and develop their analytical abilities. This balance is hard to achieve, and we must be careful not to curb intellectual freedoms by imposing dogmatic restrictions that chill teachers from adopting the pedagogical method they believe to be the most effective. So essentially, it's a win for people to criticize Christianity, at least in an educational atmosphere, although the court case is being appealed, so you never know. But it's a nice win. It's sort of a free speech win, but a good win.
Yes. You know, this reminds me of the thing that happened to Dr. Christopher DiCarlo, who was actually just in Vancouver to give a talk. He was a teacher at a Canadian university and was talking about evolution, and a First Nations student complained that by teaching evolution, he was discounting their beliefs that they had always been there and been there forever. And he tried to dialogue with the student, invited them into his class, told them to bring your elders in, we'll discuss evolution, we'll discuss your cultural heritage. And instead of doing that, they filed a grievance, and he was essentially fired. So it's good to see that this is not happening, although it is kind of troubling that language they use to describe, you know, not offending students. I don't understand that in a college atmosphere where you're supposed to be challenged. If I was suing my teachers every time they offended me, I would have had sizable legal bills. I mean, that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah, no, and actually there's an ongoing debate about whether post-secondary institutions like universities and colleges should be sort of a free speech zone where people entering it must be aware that they will likely be offended and anything can be said in this one particular area in the interest of promoting intellectual growth. But outside of that, then the normal decorums come into. So in an odd sort of way, well, hate speech would almost be allowed in a university setting, provided it was done so in an appropriate manner. And
I like how they also mentioned in the particular ruling that they're talking about balance. And, you know, we often talk about on this show how you can't swing too far to one side or the other and be dogmatic like that. And it seems like a good precedent to be setting in such a ruling that not only are they giving the teacher the go-ahead to teach as he sees fit, but recognizing that there are problems that are sort of inherent in these sort of situations.
Well, the term balance makes me nervous because, especially in science, you don't really have a lot of balance issues. You know, you're not teaching two sides when you talk about evolution and creationism. One of them is supported by evidence, one of them is not.
But the particular case is history when he's talking, like making some pretty sort of editorial comments on the feelings of serfs in the past.
But even still, there are right and wrong answers in history.
Yeah, and I would go, I would say it's more than just editorial. I mean, he's blaming religion as a social institution, as opposed to faith in a great believer, which could be parsed out. But actually, I think where Jenna has another point, especially in American context, is that if it's in regards to teaching history about European, and you say serfs and religion, great. If you're a teacher in the classroom and say to your Muslim student, so you like pedophilia because you're a Muslim? I mean, you know, Muhammad was like that. Or you say some other sort of just out of left field, not connected to the course, hateful comments. Well, that doesn't seem to be covered in this context either. So right. I think he's saying that, you know, you have to be sensitive to the feelings and beliefs of your students, but not so much so that it hinders your ability to teach your class.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, that would really be hard to justify in the context of an educational lecture. If they were talking about the historic realities of Muhammad, maybe, but just to say to someone, you know, oh, you must be a pedophile, that's that's crossing a line, I think.
Yeah, and in this particular case, I totally agree with Don. It seems as though it's sort of fostering critical thinking in the judgmental process, of passing judgment in court cases and whatnot, as opposed to just some kind of dogmatic rule that may leave some cases completely out in left field.
Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this. To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
That understanding empowers you.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Jenna, you're going to talk a bit about drug companies funding clinical trials.
So we talked a little bit about this last week, and for those that missed the show or, you know, kill their brain cells on the weekends or who might simply need a reminder, this was sort of the gist of the discussion. So drug research happens in three major stages. You have your basic research, looking into a biological process, preclinical drug studies, which study the effect of a specific compound on a condition but not in humans, and clinical trials, which are studies in people to assess safety and efficiency. So the cost of drug research is undertaken by both public funding, like government research grants and whatnot, and private funding, like that from drug companies, or, you know, big pharma. There will always be exceptions, some of which we discussed a little bit last week for those who want to go back and check out the episode. But for the most part, public funding is concentrated in early research, and the pharmaceutical companies take up much of the responsibility for funding later research in the process, including many, many, many of the clinical trials. So this means that most of the clinical trials that are taking place are directly or indirectly funded by drug companies. So direct funding would include a grant to do the trial from the company itself, whereas indirect funding includes financial conflicts of interest involving the company and one of the principal investigators, or more than one of the principal investigators. So conflict of interest sort of sounds like a no-no, but I should mention that this does not actually preclude these researchers from doing the work, but it rather is something that basically has to be declared when the research is being reported. You have to say, I am financially associated with this company, even if they didn't directly fund the study.
And can you give us an idea how often does that happen?
Very often, yeah. A lot of the times, the stipend for a researcher or some of the operating grants for their lab in general might be funded by a company that has a vested interest with something happening that they figure is sort of in the pipeline coming down the line, but that company might not have funded the actual clinical trial itself. Hmm. That money could come from either a public source or a different company even. So there's a lot of drug companies doing a lot of research in the clinical trial sector.
So one of the things I did in my research as far as the companies that are doing this research is a lot of it is being outsourced, as Jenna kind of hinted at there, to CROs. And there was a bit of a pause because I'm desperately trying to remember what CRO stands for. I think it's Cooperative Research Organization. So it's a third party who does clinical trials on the behalf of a pharmaceutical company. And this is big business. In 2007, it was like $15 billion. It's up to $20 billion in 2010. And a lot of this now is being outsourced to other nations like China or India, where the scientific standards are a bit harder to ensure, as well as the ethical standards. A good example of this was in 1996, there was an outbreak of measles, cholera, and bacterial meningitis occurring in Nigeria. Pfizer sent representatives to a town, Kano, to administer experimental antibiotic, trovaxifen, to...
I'm going to go with trovafloxacin.
What she said, to approximately 20 children.
200.
Wow. Local officials reported that more than 50 children died from this experiment, while others suffered mental and physical deformities. According to news reports, researchers did not obtain signed consent forms. The medical personnel did not tell the parents that their children were getting an experimental drugs. The lawsuit also accused Pfizer of using the outbreak to perform unapproved human testing, as well as allegedly underdosing the control group being treated so as to promote or to accentuate the effects of the drug that they were testing.
So there are obviously some examples where really horrific things are going on when companies are involved in the clinical trials. That's not most of what we're going to be talking about today, because hopefully these cases are incredibly rare, and there's more subtle problems with the funding from Big Pharma for pharmaceutical trials. But those are some examples of some pretty horrific things that can happen.
On the other side, because you're right, the horrific things hopefully are rare and not that doesn't happen that often. But there's also another kind of trial, which I don't think we're going to be talking about too much in this, but it's something, apparently it's a growing part of it. It's called seeding trials or marketing trials, which are actually a form of marketing conducted in the name of research, designed to actually target product sampling towards the selected consumer, usually the doctor. In medicine, the seeding trials are clinical trials or research studies of which the primary objective is to introduce the concept of a particular medical intervention, such as a pharmaceutical drug or device, to physicians rather than to actually test a scientific hypothesis. An example of this was a study of
Neurontin?
Tritate to efficiency profile of safety. And if you put all that together, apparently it spells STEPS, which was the name of the study, although they dropped the N, weird. Anyhow, this was a trial performed by Parker Davis to evaluate the anticonvulsant drug.
Anticonvulsant?
Thank you. In seeding trials. Detailed documents were released to litigation against Parker Davis and reviewed by several researchers in 2011 Annals of Internal Medicine. The STEPS trial was presented as a phase 4 clinical trial with the stated objective to study the efficacy, safety, tolerance, and quality of life amongst
gabapentin
users. However, the trial was actually completely uncontrolled, unblinded, and the scientific validity of the trial was considered dubious by independent external sources. Documents also revealed that the trial recruited 772 doctor investigators, many with limited research experience, provided inadequate training for investigators, and the company's sales representatives were directly involved in collecting and recording individual subject data. Again, so these weren't real trials. These were marketing schemes dressed up as trials.
So that can be one way to sort of influence the physicians inside of things, and again, is sort of outside the reviewed scientific side of things, but there can be problems in that side of things as well. So what we have to consider as the drug-consuming public is what are the consequences of the large pharmaceutical companies funding lots and lots of drug clinical trials. So there was a meta-study looking at literature examining this very topic, and it was recently published in two parts, and now I'm going to screw up my pronunciation because this is German, in the Deutsches Arzneimittelblatt International. And we will have a link to those articles so you can correct my German all you want. The details will be in the show notes, so yeah, there you go. This group found that the consequences of big pharma funding were discernible and fell into several categories. So the first category is the actual outcome of the study. So of course, this is basically whether or not the drug passes the clinical trial stage and is licensed for sale. So as it turns out, studies funded by Big Pharma tend to be more favorable outcomes for the company. So that as more of these drugs get approved for sale than drugs funded by public bodies. Now, it should be mentioned that this particular finding does have a couple of confounding factors. So as astute listeners who were tuning in last week might remind us, public funding is more common for trials of priority review compounds, which tend to differ more from previously approved drugs and sort of be more innovative. So it's easier to imagine how standard review compounds that are more often funded privately might actually have an easier time getting through the clinical trials, as there is a precedent for their modes of action, etc. However, it's something to think about that privately funding drugs tend to go better for the patent holder than those that are funded publicly. So this review also found that in these cases, the companies were able to influence study protocols. So this includes things such as what placebos were included and types of sample sizes or sample distributions, etc. But they also found that this didn't actually affect the protocol quality. So all of the methodologies and whatnot were up to snuff. There wasn't really a difference between public and private funding for most trials. But the crucial decisions, which actually can have an effect as far as the study outcome, could be influenced by the funding bodies.
So what you're saying is these were honest studies, but even though they followed the rules, there's still ways to sort of manipulate them to get a more favorable result.
Yes. So again, yeah, the protocols and everything would be absolutely approved. No one would bat an eye at that type of thing. But there are really subtle differences that it doesn't look particularly nefarious and might not be. But yeah, you can influence and sort of stack the odds using things that are really sort of established protocols. So a major problem in clinical trials in general that actually didn't have much of a difference between public and private is the selective publication problem. So this is sometimes called publication bias. Basically, you report or publish publicly results where the study showed positive results, but you don't publish either inconclusive studies or studies that turned out negatively for the drug. So this can also include multiple publications of possible results, which is really not allowed at all in any scientific area, but people do get away with repackaging old data and not making it explicitly, completely explicit that it has been published elsewhere. So publication bias is not actually a problem that's exclusive to drug trials, but is seriously pervasive in all research science, and I could go on, but there are many reasons for this. There's causes and dimensions to it, and we might sort of discuss this phenomenon more fully at a later time, but for now, suffice to say, that in the context of a drug trial, if negative results are not being published, new trials of the same drug can be designed that are slightly tweaked, again, with those sort of different parameters, to come up with a more positive result for the drug. And this is obviously questionable in the context of evaluating our medicines. So in order to combat publication bias, specifically in clinical trials, all trials are supposed to be publicly registered prior to the study reaching its conclusions. So this means that researchers are supposed to report the study methodology, and importantly, report the criteria that they are going to use to evaluate the study outcomes.
You use the word supposed to.
Yep. So this literature study also found that privately funded trials were often not registered or incompletely registered. So this basically opens the door for that publication bias. So not only do you not have to publish a study because no one knows it's happening, but if it's incompletely registered, you can change the study criteria after the data is in order to alter the overall study outcome. So again, if you don't have a clear idea or the public doesn't know the exact criteria you're using to evaluate things, you can sort of tweak that criteria so that things pass when maybe originally from your plan they wouldn't have. Again, pretty questionable.
Whose responsibility is it to register the studies, and where are they registered?
I am not 100% sure where they're registered. It is a publicly available body. Like, it's a searchable thing as far as my understanding goes. This is, I believe, in the U.S. and Germany. And it is the researcher's responsibility, as far as I know, to register them, but I'm a little bit shaky on those details. So in the same sort of vein, it was also found that often privately funded clinical trials withheld knowledge of adverse drug reactions. So this can actually potentially slip through the cracks even if the trial is properly registered, as registration talks about expected outcomes and study criteria, but not necessarily unexpected side effects. So obviously it's a bad thing if side effects aren't reported that come out of a clinical trial, as it hinders the ability for licensing boards to determine whether a drug is safe or more likely to evaluate possible contraindications, which are situations in which a certain drug is not appropriate to use. So basically, yeah, in more often in privately funded drug trials, people weren't actually reporting in the final publication some of the adverse reactions that were experienced by trial participants. And again, you can get away with that because it's not in the registration. So the final findings of this study unearthed more issues regarding publication. Firstly, that there are often publication constraints put on study authors in privately funded endeavors that severely limits their ability to publish study-related data independently. So basically, they're only allowed to publish this under the umbrella of the funding body. This, of course, gives extra control of information dissemination to the funding body. And finally, the company can also introduce an element of spin by using ghostwriters or guest authors. Ghostwriters include writers that did actually contribute to the work. So this is often company statisticians or that kind of thing that can have sort of an effect on the data, but who don't actually get listed as authors and are not acknowledged anywhere to have worked on the paper. And this is totally not kosher in scientific research. And then there's the issue of guest authors. And these are sort of the opposite. These are big name scientists listed as authors who really did not contribute significantly to the work. Either case is deceptive and can help skew perspective with respect to how the work is received. So in short, there are some serious issues that are innate in private funding bodies funding clinical trials. So these are not always happening on purpose. So it's not always sort of the pharmacy man trying to get you. Although the pharmacy man mostly gives you cough medication, so we should not blame him. So there's not always some nefarious intent, but statistically these problems do exist. So as we talked about last week, the funding burden is split between private and public centers. And I, for one, am not perfectly convinced that either could manage to fund these necessary innovations on their own. It is, however, really vital that both consumers and regulators are aware of the pitfalls of publicly funded drug trials and insist upon measures that are designed to minimize these pitfalls.
You mean privately funded?
I do mean privately funded. Thank you.
Yes. So
they both start with P. It's very difficult.
Private funded research, bad. Public funded research, good. But
Don, have you been listening at all?
I just wanted everyone to know that capitalism is evil, and when the revolution comes, all drug research will be done by authorized government officials, and you will get your pills and the
Oh, go take your placenta pill.
Nice. Well, thanks, Jenna. We'll have to keep our eye on that interesting science factoids there. We're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about the Pope in Spain. Now, I already blogged about this last week, but just to sort of go over some of the interesting developments, Pope Ratzinger visited Spain for the World Youth Day celebrations. Now, since Spain is a heavily Catholic country, you would expect the Pope to receive a very warm welcome, but this was not the case. So at this Catholic Festival for the Youth, which is August 16th to the 21st, and this year in Madrid, organizers were speculating that they could have up to 1 million people who would be celebrating the Pope's visit, which would culminate in a big open-air mass on Sunday. But perhaps surprisingly, a large number of people in Spain weren't happy about the Pope's visit. And a lot of the dissatisfaction comes from the huge cost of the event. There's a group in Spain, the 15M Group, which is an anti-austerity spending group. And they sort of were very upset about a lot of the spending cuts that have come to sort of social welfare and whatnot. They have a quote here that I'd like to read. "We are not angry about the Pope's visit, which some will agree with and others won't, but rather over the financing of it with public money, especially at a time when many services are being cut because it's necessary to curb government spending." So basically, it's kind of the old story that public money is being used to finance the Pope's visit, which has got a lot of people very upset.
But Ethan, I was reading somewhere that the Pope's office and the Catholic people are claiming that 70% of the money is coming from pilgrims' tickets, and that 30% is private donations.
The Vatican has claimed that funding, the majority of funding, is coming from the Vatican, which I have not been able to confirm. In fact, the New York Times suggested that the pilgrims who are visiting actually received an 80% discount on public transportation, even though the indebted Madrid authorities recently raised the cost of a regular subway ticket by 50%. Additionally, a lot of the protesters are carrying banners that read, "The Pope travels, the Pope pays." Because the Pope is actually the head of the Vatican State, I think he does get a lot of state funding for his diplomatic visits.
So, Don, just to recap, public funding bad, private funding good.
Yes, yes. In addition, there's a lot of upset people because of Spain's secular government. Many people believe that the Pope's visit, and especially the fact that many of the pilgrims who are coming have been given state facilities to stay in, violates sort of the secular spirit of Spain's constitution. And many of the pilgrims have been allowed to stay in schools and public buildings, and this is rather upsetting to a larger the number of the secularists in Spain. In addition, of course, there's the usual band of, angry atheists like ourselves, and also gay rights activists and others who oppose Catholic ideology and are upset that Spain is giving the Pope a pulpit to spew his ideology from. Now, to make matters worse, the Pope has offered a 6-day abortion forgiveness option. Now, in the divine wisdom that only the Vatican can come up with, over 200 confessional booths are being set up in Madrid for women who have had abortions. Now, from the Catholic point of view, this is, I think, a very good thing, because if you have an abortion, you can get excommunicated, which means hell forever. So from their point of view, this is a really wonderful thing they're offering. Now, I think you do have to give it to the Catholics in some regard. For a religion that's leadership is exclusively male, they sure know how to respond to a situation that they lack necessary organs to even experience.
So is this like a religious fire sale? Like, 6 days only, once in a lifetime opportunity. Come get the deal of a lifetime and be forgiven for your abortion.
Pretty much, actually.
I think it's funny, too, is that these people need forgiveness for destroying something, the soul, that doesn't exist. And if they do, they're going to go to a place, hell, which doesn't exist. And all this is some sort of deal?
Well, the funny thing is, if you are a Catholic and you want to take advantage of this only 6-day abortion forgiveness thing.
And you don't happen to live in Madrid?
You have to fly to Madrid. So I was reading an article on Slate Magazine, and they were saying that for this, you know, get out of hell card, if you're a Catholic in America or Canada, you need to get a last-minute ticket to Madrid, find accommodations, food, and, you know, drop whatever it is you're doing right now, work, school, life, to get
sex.
your sure, why not, to get your get-out-of-hell card. A cheaper option is to just not be a Catholic anymore. That's free. And, in fact, you might get a few benefits from that as well.
Well, you wouldn't have to pay your tithings or anything like that, right? I mean, Catholic churches are expensive to upkeep, and they need money from their parishioners, and
sure.
So you'd be saving that.
You know, I think the huge point about this is just the hypocrisy of the Catholic Church holding women to some sort of higher standard about what they do with their bodies when they can't even control the pedophilia within their own organization. I don't know why the Catholic Church thinks that they have sort of a right to dictate what one group of people does with their, you know, sexual organs when they can't even control sexual predators within their own organization.
Oh, I know. God.
Well, I guess...
When you deal with a fiction, you can make up whatever rules you want, and they don't have to make sense.
Yeah. I guess that is their sort of ultimate defense. Of course, us
defending
atheists.
Quotes.
Yeah. Well, we don't really buy that. To be sort of a dick about this, I'd like to wonder if the Catholic Church is going to offer a special dispensation for women who are raped by clergy or those within the church. Surely they don't have to be forgiven, and if they do, surely these women shouldn't have to pay to fly all the way to Madrid to be forgiven.
I wonder if this is going to become a regular thing, you know, a summer special. Next year, maybe it will be. Maybe they'll give a special dispensation to murderers. Say, hey, did you kill a friend of yours or someone you didn't like? Well, for 3 days only, you can get that sin washed away with Pope's miracle water. Just come to Madrid or wherever it happens to be. And do they have to pay for this?
Yeah.
Well, it seems in the great, you know, tradition of taking over other holidays that maybe this is the one opportunity Catholicism has to take over Halloween.
Just, well, it's not happening on Halloween, though.
I know, but it could. Think of the possibilities. Every year, Sin Forgiveness Week, and you wait desperately until, you know, the previous Halloween to figure out what sin you're going to be able to be forgiven for that year.
Yeah, that sounds like one of my jokes, actually.
And then instead of eating candy, you could, you know, chomp on wafers and pray.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I wonder if they're going to have that, chocolate-coated communion wafers.
Now, that's a way to draw people into the church, I think. Well, why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker? When we come back, we'll have an interview with Neil deGrasse Tyson, our final TAM 9 interview. So stay tuned for that here on the show.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. A picture called The Big Trail. Well, I've made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that...
CITR!
Can be mighty helpful.
Yeah!
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is Professor Neil deGrasse Tyson, host of the popular TV show Nova Science Now, as well as an accomplished author, astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the Rowe Center for Earth and Space. Dr. Tyson, thanks for joining us on Radio Freethinker.
Thank you. Does that mean I'm a freethinker? Is that what that implies?
That's what we hope. You are a freethinker.
I think how I want. Is that counts as a free thinker?
That sounds perfect.
No, I think in whatever direction the evidence takes me.
Ah, that's even better.
That's even better, yeah.
So start us off. Tell us how you got into being a popularizer of science.
It was not on purpose. I was really just minding my own business. And being based in New York City, where the major news gathering headquarters of the nation are based, and more recently, well, at least 8-10 years ago, CNN now has a major headquarters in New York, outside of Atlanta, the universe would flinch, and I'm just an easy date for them. They don't have to fly me anywhere. They either send up an action cam or pay my cab fare to go to their studio, settings. And so it started out that way. I was just sort of easy for them. But I realized that when I would give them my best professorial replies to questions they had about the universe, they would heavily sort of soundbite it. Mm-hmm. They would hack it into pieces and reassemble it in ways that serve their needs. And I thought, why not hand them the soundbite up front? They don't have to chop anything up. So I serve them the dish that they're seeking. And so then I started practicing soundbites, just so that the integrity of my message would not risk being compromised. So it was more a survival mechanism than anything else. Then I found out that they started returning and even beating a path back to my door. They liked the sound bites. They exploited how they could use a sound bite in their pieces. A sound bite is an ideal sound bite is informative, enlightening, because those are not the same thing, to be informative and enlightening. At its best, it'll make you smile, and you'll be dying to tell someone else.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you decide to start doing Nova? And
right, so that's just how it started. And then the folks at Nova, which is PBS up in Boston, saw me in multiple ways and times in these programs, and then they knocked on my door and said, we are thinking about having you host the show. So I didn't invent the show. These are some creative people who, in Nova Science Now, as a spinoff of Nova, which we all know and love. It's been around since the 1970s. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it defined the television science documentary genre. And for it being so long and so successful at what it did. So they knocked on my door, and I realized what they were asking of me was a combination of things. Things I would say or perform or act or explore in the role of a correspondent in a piece, that all these things I may have had like unique capability to put them all together in the way they were seeking. Mm-hmm. So I thought I'd give it a try. And they were happy with it, and the audience was happy. And so we just finished our fifth year of Nova Science Now.
Excellent. One of the common topics at TAM has been how to make science and skepticism interesting to mainstream audiences. So how do you and the producers of Nova Science Now address that question?
Yeah, I think it's a little... I think some of that energy, as much as half of that energy, is misdirected. Mm-hmm. It's directed at... You know, it says, oh, you've got a cut on your foot. Let's find the best Band-Aid for it. Rather than, you got a cut on your foot, let's find a way to prevent the cut from having gotten there in the first place. Mm. My read of the skeptics movement, which might be shallow on the surface, that's what I guess shallow means, it's on the surface, because I don't count myself among those who are in the trenches in the skeptics movement, so I'm hesitant to pass glib judgment on it. But from where I sit, it looks as though a major effort of the skeptics movement is to undo the tangled mental roadways that lead people to think astray. Mm-hmm. And my goal as an educator and as a scientist is to ensure that the mental roadways never ended up tangled in the first place. And if when you've done that, then the mind is completely open to rational thinking. By the way, not all science is rational. There's nothing rational about a quantum mechanical wave function collapsing at one point when it's measured at it. I mean, just as stuff goes on in quantum mechanics, yeah, it's mathematically rational, but it's not rational to your common sense.
Not intuitive.
Intuitive, that's the word I'm looking for here. Thanks. And so, because it falls outside of your life experience. So I don't want to say to be skeptical is to be rational. What I want to say is to be skeptical is to explore the causes and effects of things in whatever way you can to account for what you see. Mm-hmm. And so if you train someone how to do that investigating, then the skepticism is built within it. It's not a separately trained act.
Right. And as an educator, how do you confront problems where science is sort of preemptively kept away from students? Evolution has such hoops to jump through to get taught in many schools. The origin of the universe, the Big Bang Theory, has all these political correctness and red tape around it.
Yeah, it turns out the Big Bang is not as controversial as that we have ape ancestors in common with chimps. And in my talk, I will give evidence of that, or actually an anecdote regarding it. So, yeah, there's resistance. It's not everywhere. I still think it's the fringe. Mm-hmm. The religious fundamentalists are the primary opponents of it. They are not the majority of Christian fundamentalists in the nation. The minority. They just have the biggest mouths. So there's a distorted representation of their actual numerical strength.
Right.
I always wondered if states contain the level of autonomy that they're supposed to have. It would be interesting if a state declared that they won't teach evolution or they'll teach creation alongside of it, and people who did not want any part of it just moved out of the state.
Mm-hmm. It'd
be an interesting consequence.
Yeah.
Because you would lose all of your engineers and most of your engineers and scientists. There's some engineers and scientists who remain religious, of course, but the majority would not, and they would just move out. Mm-hmm. And there'd be this brain drain from your state, and then you'd have no economy and you'd go bankrupt. That's kind of like the science fiction future scenario.
Yeah.
Of a culture or of a...
A dystopia, perhaps.
A dystopia, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about when you first applied for your undergraduate at Cornell University, you found yourself meeting with Carl Sagan. He's a personal hero of mine. I'm curious, what was it like?
Evidently, you got him all over your shirt.
I know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you get a chance to work with Carl Sagan?
No, never collaborated on anything. Not that that mattered. Well, what matters, at least in that context, by the way, we were kind of a half generation separate from each other. So, you know, he's got graduate students, but I'm just entering college mm-hmm. when this happens, right? So, I guess I could have worked with him as a college student. That happens. But I was already clear on what I wanted to be when I grew up, long before I met Carl. So, unlike the stories that so many people can tell of him, that he turned them on to science or to the universe, I can say that what I got from Carl was not that, but that it was a measure of dignity and respect that he shared with me that I now share with all students who come to my office. Not a day goes by without that happening and me not thinking of Carl.
Let's talk a bit about Pluto. Why did Pluto...
Get over it.
What's wrong with Pluto?
Pluto, it's not anything new that's wrong. It's been wrong since it was discovered.
Mm-hmm.
It's... Pluto. You know, there's 7 moons in the solar system bigger than Pluto, including Earth's moon. Earth's moon is 5 times more massive than Pluto itself. And if Pluto were where Earth is right now, we would grow a tail from the heat of the sun. That's just no kind of behavior for a planet.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, that we found other objects in the outer solar system that resemble Pluto more than either of them resemble any other planet. And anytime you have that scenario, that counts as a new class of object.
Right.
And so Pluto is a prototype member of a new class of object called Pluto, called dwarf planets. And then there's a subcategory of dwarf planets of objects that have similar orbit to Pluto. And those are called Plutoids.
Okay.
Which sounds like some kind of disease you need
to
solve for.
And like, why did it take so long for us to have sort of a clear-cut definition of what is and what isn't a planet?
Because it was never defined before.
Mm.
It was a grandfathered-in understanding of how you'd use the word planet that was never challenged because we didn't have data sets broad enough, such as what we obtained in the 90s, to say, hey, wait a minute, that doesn't match that. And that's why you always want more data.
Mm-hmm.
More data is always better than less data.
And are there other celestial objects that are undergoing perhaps a similar situation where there's not a clear-cut definition?
Earth is next. No, Pluto was the one with the controversy.
Okay.
And there was sentiment. There was like
There was a lot of, emotion mm-hmm. attached to it.
Yep.
What about the fact that we've only explored a relatively small part of the universe? We're going to encounter phenomenon that challenge clear-cut definitions. How do you anticipate those problems?
We should have waited until we had cataloged many more exoplanets
mm-hmm.
and planetary systems to decide how we redefine a planet. That's my opinion on the matter.
Okay.
As it was currently defined, it is defined only in the context of our own solar system.
Right.
Which to me is highly limited, given what you need to have to get that to work.
Right. And what direction would you like to see space exploration go? Would you like to go to Mars?
Yeah, sure. Mars, asteroids. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
With humans.
With humans. Yeah. So you're in favor of manned space exploration.
Oh, yeah. Because I recognize, in ways that some of my colleagues don't, what power of influence that has over the ambitions of students in the educational pipeline.
Right.
It's an extraordinary force. And you do it because it has that influence. You don't do it because it's your best science solution.
Right. What about visiting the moons of Saturn and Jupiter? I've heard.
I'd love that. They're very far away, though.
Yes.
We're not there yet.
Right.
I don't see that happening in my lifetime.
When you see humans on Mars?
If I ran Congress, I see humans on Mars the day China says they're going to build military bases on Mars. Then we'll be on Mars 10 months after that.
So we need a new sort of arms race for space.
I would hope not. You know, I say that half glibly, but we know something like that might just unfold.
Right.
If that was the course of events. So I think there are other ways to have milestone moments that can galvanize people. And among them is the promise that such a project will stimulate an unprecedented interest in science, technology, engineering, and math, out of which tomorrow gets invented.
Mm-hmm. And do you encounter a lot of pseudoscience in studying the origins of the universe?
No.
No?
No. People don't know enough to jump in. You get a lot of pseudoscience where people don't like relativity.
Right.
They have an explanation, they believe, for dark matter or dark energy. But the Big Bang, not really. Its foundations are growing stronger daily by the day.
Okay. Do you think that there's a link between a general interest in science and accepting pseudosciences like creationism?
I saw a study recently that implied that, and I found it hard to believe. It implied that the more scientifically literate you were, the more susceptible you were to believe things that were not scientific.
Hmm.
I didn't quite wrap my head around that.
That does sound counterintuitive. What about for the average person who just isn't interested in science? It goes over their head. Do you think that they're especially vulnerable to be taken in by pseudoscience?
If they reject science, they're susceptible to pseudoscience.
Right.
But if they just don't understand it, I think you can still sustain a healthy dose of skepticism in spite of that.
Mm. Finally, I have to ask you, were on an episode of Stargate Atlantis.
Yeah, yeah.
So what kind of science fiction do you like? Obviously, Atlantis.
I do more movie watching than book reading, mm-hmm. and so I like a good science fiction spectacle on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like Contact. I like Deep Impact. Carl Sagan's Contact, of course. Deep Impact. I liked. I saw 2001 again recently, and it's still a very slow movie, but nonetheless, it was an interesting vision of the future.
Definitely.
And no one hardly does that anymore, the near-term future.
Yes.
That you can reach out and touch. They go centuries ahead, so you'll never be alive, or they ignore it altogether.
So you're not a big fan of the Star Treks and the... Well, Star Wars was in the past, supposedly. But
you asked me how much what science fiction do I read? That's different from.
I mean, like Star Trek in terms of it takes place in the 22nd century.
Oh yeah, no, that's fine. I'm just saying it's less tangibly. It's not there.
Right.
For the taking.
Yes.
The way you can imagine setting it up so that it is.
Right.
And, but I'm old enough to have watched the original Star Trek when it came out once a week. And there's some episodes there that remind you why the show got canceled. So, you know, we remember the great ones, so there's some self-editing going on there.
Yeah, selective memory there.
Yeah, selective memory.
Well, Dr. Tyson, thank you for joining us on Radio Free Thinker.
I'm happy to be with you.
Please join us in Vancouver.
Do I pass the test as a free thinker?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. You are a pinnacle of skepticism in my book. Even if you are skeptical of skepticism.
Yeah, I'm skeptical of skepticism.
Well,
at its extreme.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. We're all connected to each other biologically, to the earth chemically, to the rest of the universe atomically.
Find it elevating and exhilarating to discover that we live in a universe which permits the evolution of molecular machines as intricate and subtle as we are.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Our thanks to Neil deGrasse Tyson for the interview. And that wraps up our TAM9 interviews. So hopefully next year we'll have a whole bunch of new ones.
Yes, hopefully next year we will have new ones and many of them.
Yes, because we love them.
Yes.
Well, we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. I have a couple here that should be of interest to our listeners. The first one is Skeptics in the Pub, Richmond, which happens Thursday, August 25th, 7:30 p.m. at Legends Pub, which is on 6511 Boswell Street in Richmond, B.C., which is very close to the SkyTrain, very accessible to everyone who wants to go to that. And then another fun event that's coming up is the Humanist Summer Potluck, which is Friday, August 26th. That's at 6 p.m. at the Oak Ridge Senior Center at 41st Street in Vancouver. The BC Humanists are having a potluck dinner, so bring your favorite appetizer, entree, or dessert. Meet at the Oak Ridge Senior Center at 6 p.m., and they'll welcome you in and have a good time.
I always wondered whether, you know, potluck dinners should be regulated, you know, as a form of gambling. Because, I mean, literally, you have no idea what you're going to eat there or what's going to be available. And it just...
Are you exchanging money at potlucks?
No. But, you know, you're sort of betting your food in the hopes to win better food from other people. So
I don't think it's going to be that competition, but, yeah.
You could totally settle down with your own casserole on your knee.
Okay, that would work. My skeptic highlight actually is a priming the pump. The deaths of addiction. There have been a number of articles in the newsosphere about the recent decision by the American Society of Addiction Medicine to classify addiction, be it alcohol, cocaine, or sex addiction, as a mental disorder. Traditional addiction has been seen, at least in the initiation of the addiction, as a moral failing or a weakness of the mind. But modern research has brought much of this quote-unquote common sense into doubt. The American Society statement holds that the addiction really is a biopsychosocial spiritual illness. Although addiction can't be chosen by the addicts, they can choose to get treatment. Recovery, the society says, is best realized not just by self-management and mutual support groups, such as 12-step fellowships, but also by trained professionals. The AA, the society's timing corresponds with the current revamping of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. That's the Bible for mental illness in the United States, actually in the world. So I was just wondering if, you know, if our listeners could check out these links. It'll be on our show notes. And one, let us know if you agree with the basic premise that is addiction a disease or is it some weakness in one's moral character? The use of spirituality in treating addictions, like with the 12-step programs. And the other, like I say, the timing of this. One of the things that I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about was if you make addiction as a mental illness, then those people who treat the mental illness sort of have it elevated. They're like on level of doctors as opposed to social therapists sort of thing. So there seems to be a lot of different ways you can take on this particular article. And I would love to hear what people have to think and say about this. If you email us at info@radiofreethinker.com and just give us your thoughts about this, because I'm sure this will be a future segment one way or another.
We've mentioned the new psychological Bible, the DSMV or whatever the abbreviation is, many times now already. So I'm looking forward to actually, well, not reading it, but having a complete version so that we can learn
Ethan's
about it.
Ethan's got it by his bedside. Don't be fooled. Don't be fooled.
Well, it's one of those things, too, is that like the new publication, I think, is still a couple of years away, but it's one of those things they kind of leak sections of it out there to see whether it has validity or not before they put it in stone, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
I think it's printed on paper. But something that will probably not be a future segment. There was an earthquake this morning in Virginia, and it got everyone talking about whether or not they felt it and how it was for them. So there's a site from the U.S. Geological Survey called Did You Feel It? We'll have the link on our page, and it lets you sort of let everyone know whether or not you could feel it where you were and what kind of damage there was, and basically creates a map of everyone's experience and how far the damage and the sensation of an earthquake can spread. And it's a really interesting way to, in a very pictorial form, look at the impact of specific earthquakes around the U.S. I didn't have time to see whether or not there's something in Canada.
Interesting side note about that. I was just listening to one of my podcasts on that, and they were mentioning that the nuclear power plant that's in Virginia, that's near where this had happened, about 15 years ago, disassembled its seismic sensors because of budget cuts. So one place you won't be getting information about is from the nuclear power plant.
You know what this means? The same way that trailer parks attract tornadoes,
nuclear power plants
attract earthquakes. God, I love it when I can put two and two together.
Excellent. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying I'll see you next week.
This is Don saying mind's on, eyes open.
Turning it around. And this is Jenna saying, remember, the real world is amazing.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise.